This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If you're on YouTube or Instagram or anywhere else on social media, you might notice a phrase that comes up over and over and over.
So guys, today is Sunday, and Sundays mean self-care Sundays. I don't know about you guys, but I love to spend my Sundays doing absolutely nothing, and I just want to spend the day to take care of myself and take care of my home, you know, clean and just like get myself ready to start the week.
I thought that I would film like a self-care routine because I have a pamper day on my summer bucket list. A self-care day is super, super needed if you're feeling like stressed or if you just want to like reset, relax, and be really happy.
Today is Sunday, one of my favorite days of the week. Sundays are when I set myself up for the week. I do lots of self-care. Come hang out with me today. Self-care Sunday.
Self-care, wellness, those terms come up a lot these days, and it's no wonder. The wellness industry makes a lot of money. By some estimates, more than $4 trillion a year. But what is the wellness industry? What does it mean to take care of ourselves? And when a company promises it can help make you a better person, when should you believe it? Joining us from NPR in New York is Amanda Mull, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Amanda, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Also at NPR in New York is Elisa Schenkel, co-founder of Heal House, which is a wellness space in Brooklyn. Elisa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And at KQED Public Radio in San Francisco is Dr. Jen Gunter, an OBGYN, and the author of The Vagina Bible, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine. Dr. Gunter, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gunter, can I start with you? Can you just define this term wellness for us? When you hear that word, what do you think?
Well, now it's hard to know what to think. I mean, it's in many ways like the terms natural and organic, and it seems to have changed to suit almost really whatever product is being sold. But, you know, the WHO definition is changes toward a healthy and fulfilling life, and it involves physical, mental, and social well-being, not just the absence of disease or illness.
Amanda Mull, how would you compare that concept of wellness to what we commonly think of as self-care?
Well, I think that self-care has been sort of co-opted by a lot of brands looking to sell particular things and sort of transformed into, you know, a term that refers to a type of product that you buy and then use in your personal grooming routines or in your relaxation routines. It can be, you know, bath products or skincare products or things like that. I think that self-care has sort of been pretty narrowly defined by a lot of companies in the past several years.
Elisa, what about you? That line between wellness and self-care, or are they kind of the same thing?
You know, it's so funny. I kind of have a problem with the word self-care these days, similarly to Amanda, how it's been co-opted, because it can be anything, really. And my experience with wellness is really going deeper and going deeper into the experience of healing and encouraging that for others and not just approaching self-care from the surface. So these days, when people ask me, what is wellness? What is self-care? I've kind of developed my own answer in the sense of it's really awareness at bare bones minimum. It's getting in touch with who you are, asking yourself questions, asking your body, mind, and spirit what's going on, what needs to be addressed, what needs to be assessed, who can I ask for help? So I like to say that right now for me is the beginning journey of what wellness and self-care is and all the other things as far as like what you can do about it and the different healing modalities and how you can experience your own self-care is the journey.
Anika, or Anika, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, wrote on our Facebook page, please don't confuse this self-indulgence with self-care. Amanda, I think that's an interesting point, but where do you see that line, if there is one?
I think that line is really blurred in the self-care discourse that we have now. I think that self-care, as you know, the concept was articulated first, which was by Audre Lorde, who was a civil rights activist and poet. I think that kind of self-care doesn't have a lot to do with indulgence. It has much more to do with keeping yourself, you know, sort of strong and ready to face day-to-day life and the challenges that are inherent in that for a lot of people, and especially a lot of women and women of color. But now I think that in order to make that marketable, Self-care has turned into an idea of self-indulgence, and, you know, the ultimate in self-care, you know, according to a lot of Instagram and YouTube accounts in the past couple of years is, you know, taking a nice bath or doing a face mask. And those things can be nice. And if those things feel rejuvenating to you, then go for it. But I think that there's a big difference between buying yourself something fancy and doing the hard work of, meeting daily challenges and things like that.
Elisa, I'd love you to jump in on that because I'm glad you mentioned the term. And Audre Lorde, the activist, cultural critic, author, coined that term, self-care. She said, quote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare," unquote. Again, that's a quote from Audre Lorde. Elisa, how do you see that? That you caring for oneself as a political act is almost a radical act.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many things about this. I don't even like to use the word self-care, so I'm going to take it back to healing. I see healing as a lifestyle. It's not something that's just a one-off. And I feel like with this self-care movement, it's something that, you know, I'm going to do this temporarily because it makes me feel good in the moment. And that is a fine line because there are certain things that are just nourishing for people and healing for them that maybe has more of like a shallow context, which is fine. But it's kind of dangerous when you start using that as this is how I'm healing myself, right? And so I often say that healing is a lifestyle. It's something that, you know, I don't choose, you know, to do as a one-off every day. It's something that I do to wake up in the morning to survive, to thrive, to be able to show up in the world the best way that I can and have my cup full and then be able to facilitate holding space for other people. And this idea of self-care or healing being a political act is really interesting to me. And I really feel strongly in support of that statement because, I mean, just as someone that, you know, I own a wellness space. I've been through my own personal trauma. I've done the work to, you know, undo a lot of old paradigms, to heal things that have happened to me. And for me, that was an act of survival. That was an act of getting out of survival mode and back into my life and thriving. And I feel like if you are going to show up in the world and be able to do the best that you can at what you're doing and be able to serve others without a deficit of yourself, which I feel like a lot of people are existing that way, right? Of doing all the things, but losing themselves in the process, not being able to have enough for themselves. And it is a political act to choose yourself and to choose yourself because knowing that by choosing yourself, you are going to be able to show up and do what you need to do for other people in the most efficient way.
We'll talk more about the industry of self-care or wellness or healing in just a moment. But Dr. Gunter, just to clarify before we pause, if I've had a rough day and I decide to come home and get stoned or get drunk or get high, is that self-care?
Well, as a physician, I would say that, you know, chemical coping is something that people have to be concerned about, right? So I think that self-care, as I would think defined by the medical community, it probably wouldn't fit in there. And I think that's a really important thing maybe for us to get at in a little bit is that, are you looking for a health benefit or are you looking for just something that makes you feel better? Because those are two different things.
So this is kind of different than, say, if I'm someone who deals with chronic pain and I found that cannabis can help ease my pain. That's a different kind of thing.
Well, you know, I think that it's, as a doctor, again, we would have to go back to clinical trials and what does that say? Because it's very, many of this is very predatory, right? So wellness makes all kinds of claims and then there's very little data to back any of it up. So what we would recommend as a physician and what people want to try and do on their own might be very different too.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with Dr. Jen Gunter, Atlantic staff writer Amanda Moll, and Heal House co-founder Elisa Shankle. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you've done very well to listen to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Self-care. I'm treating me right. Yeah, we're gonna be alright.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, works to enhance the lives of her aging clients and their families. Here, she shares her golden rule for care.
I would want her to be treated the way I'd want to be treated.
I come in and take care of her and do all of her personal care needs that she needs done and make sure she stays comfortable in her own home. We have a good time. We're best friends.
To learn more about Homestead Senior Care's in-home care options, go to homestead.com.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, and this week we bring you a portrait of Isabel Allende.
My job as a writer, as an activist, as a philanthropist, as a feminist, is to create awareness and to say, okay, this is what I see.
It's Latino USA from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the wellness industry and the growing trends in self-care. Some of you decided to leave us a voicemail. Here's a quick montage of a little bit of what you left in our inbox.
Hi, I'm Lois from Denver, Colorado, and I'm 87 years old and want to talk about wellness. First of all, wellness isn't just one thing to do. It's really the connection of body, mind, and spirit.
What I do for self-care is I get a monthly massage, and that's about $70. I also go to yoga. I practice meditation.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I'm calling from Gainesville, Florida. Self-care is an important aspect of my life and has essentially saved my life. Having to confront and deal with issues of drug addiction have helped me to overcome problems that probably would have or definitely threatened my life.
Hi, this is Hannah calling from Portland, Maine. I find that most ideas about self-care are helping us to cope with a society that demands that we put so much stress on our bodies and on our schedules. And so instead, my way of self-care has been to really set healthy boundaries with when I'm going to answer my emails and when I have to say, no, this is my time.
Elisa, what about you? When do you most need self-care and what helps the most?
I need self-care daily. I have to do something every single day to keep myself aligned. So I really loved one of the comments that one of the people said about, you know, self-care is it's a holistic experience. It's body, mind, and spirit. So I have to tend to all aspects. So if I feel like I need to just divulge everything that's in my head, I have a therapist who I've been with for a very long time, and it's something that I do to keep my mental health intact. And then I have a different range of medicinal herbs that I use for stress in the body, stress in, you know, whether it's anxiety stress. So that's everything from Nervines, which are really great for the nervous system, to CBD oil, which is like a super lifestyle for me. And then I also meditate. Meditate is huge. Meditation's huge. I wake up at least 15 minutes every morning or in the evening to just really connect, like reconnect my mind and my body, because I feel like in New York City, we're always running around and often we disconnect both. And so that's something that really keeps me grounded. So that's a couple things that I do.
Dr. Gunter, what about you?
I really just look for fellowship with friends, community, exercise, hanging out with my kids who make me laugh all the time.
Amanda, what do you think about some of the imagery and the marketing around the self-care industry? I mean, as I'm sitting here thinking about self-care, I think one of the things that I tend to do lately for self-care is ride my motorcycle. I bought a Harley back in April, and I love it because it forces me out of my brain and into my body, and it forces me to be in the moment, and it breaks me away from a life where everyone is demanding things from me and thinking things about me and making assumptions and the high expectations and the high stress and constantly being on. And being on your bike under a helmet, anonymous, zipping through traffic, forces me into one moment. But everything I see in self-care is very soft and very dulcet, and is about getting in touch with yourself and quieting your mind and just feeling your inner beauty and your inner glow. And that's not who I am. I need a different kind of self-care. And it feels like just the imagery around the marketing might be leaving some of us who really need care behind.
Yes, I think that the marketing of self-care by companies is very feminized, is very much seeking to sort of tap into like traditional ideas of femininity, and I think that's largely because self-care, as we know it as a corporate construct, is largely the rebranding of beauty products and of products that are meant to hone your physical appearance, whether that's diet products or skincare products or anti-aging products or makeup. I think that that women in general, American women, have gotten sort of tired of being told how to look. And I think that the way that a lot of those beauty companies and aesthetics companies are finding a way around that is to rebrand those products and recontextualize those products as products that are intended for, you know, the ultimate care of your spirit, when actually they're just the same beauty products, the same diet products that have always existed, which I think is the reason that you see so much, so many sort of feminine indicators around those types of products, because those products have always been marketed to women. And so the sort of rebranding of them is still going to be for women. And that does leave a lot of people out. It makes men, you know, I think men are under a lot of stress in American culture too, and need emotional outlets probably in a lot of ways more than women do, because, you know, traditionally men are not allowed to feel bad, to feel tired, to feel anything but, you know, in control.
To feel weak.
Right. They're not allowed to feel weak. And I think that the sort of ultra-feminine branding of the idea of self-care does a disservice to people who exist outside of that very strict gender construct, who are looking for ways to, you know, hold some space for themselves in the world, to feel better, to find outlets.
Alisa, to that point in terms of the marketing, Tamara emailed, can your guests please talk about the racial and socioeconomic issues in the wellness industry? Who has the access? Who is the face of the industry? Alisa, I think this gets at the heart of the nature of your company, right?
Absolutely. It's a huge, huge question. Overall, yeah, there's just really a lack of inclusivity and diversity within the wellness space in general. So that's everything from when you actually go to a physical space and it's all clinical white. And then on the practitioner end, there's not a lot of diversity. So say for someone that's a person of color to come into a space and feel like, okay, I'm about to want to place my trauma in your hands, but not seeing themselves reflected is always an issue. And I mean, even just inclusivity in general, right? So LGBTQ, men, non-binary folk, and that being represented in the visual of like marketing campaigns for different wellness brands and companies. It's not something that you see included. It's not something that you see prioritized beyond like a token or just to basically check the diversity box. It's not something that's integrated. And also to that accessibility point, right? So price point, you know, things that, you know, I've been purchasing for a very long time, whether it's ashwagandha powder or it's moringa powders that also come from these indigenous cultures, are things that are being packaged and marked up. And this is something that I can literally go to the store and buy for super cheap, right? These things are being co-opted and sold as these products that aren't really, that really are accessible to people, but are basically told that like, you need to buy it at this price, right? So something that we do at Heal House is we try to hold space for everyone. And even just my business partner is a male, and that was a huge part of what we were doing, because men are left out of this conversation. And they feel intimidated by going to these spaces. They feel intimidated about things like meditation and yoga or wellness products. And it's, how do you hold space for them? How do you create programming? How do you bring in practitioners that reflect who they are? And then the same thing with people of color. It's making sure that when you are holding space or you have practitioners, making sure that the entire business reflects the collective, so people feel comfortable to come in. And I think the intimidation thing is also a huge part of it as well. So creating a space that has familiar notes to really invite people in. So that's, whether that's having, you know, at our space we have, you know, hip hop music, we have alternative mm-hmm. music. We really try to cater to what people already experience rather than appropriating religion or appropriating a certain way of how a quote unquote wellness space should feel.
Yeah.
I think people are scared to step out of the box and really create something and present something that is familiar to people. So I say all the time, my job is to convert souls. But in that way, it's like bringing people in and giving them something that they can bite onto that feels like it's not stigmatized, that feels familiar, so they can come in. So for instance, like with our therapy services,
right.
You know, people can get a smoothie in the bar and go downstairs, and it's not in a clinical environment. It's very normal. It's very comfortable. There's yeah. community, and you really take away that intimidation factor. And I think that in the mainstream, things like mental health are stigmatized. And I think that it's time that we strip away what quote unquote, environments is supposed to look like, where people are supposed yeah. to go to health services, or what it looks like according to how it's marketed to us.
I do want to talk to you about some of the companies that are prominent in this industry, including the one that is run by Gwyneth Paltrow. We'll get to that ahead. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
There are places in the United States where voting districts are made up mostly of prisoners who can't vote.
Forgive me for not having been able to articulate this the way I want to, but it's almost like your body being used.
On NPR's Code Switch, the connection between the U.S. Census, politics, and prisons.
Back now to our conversation with Amanda Mull, Elisa Shankle, and Dr. Jen Gunter. Let me get through a few more of your comments now. Jean wrote on our Facebook page, "I have a rare chronic blood cancer. I've been told that the oral chemo keeping me alive is poison and that I should take turmeric, CBD oil, or other things. I have been admonished to fast, cleanse, follow an anti-inflammatory diet, and my favorite, to use black salve to draw out the cancer. None of this stuff has any proven benefit for cancer patients. Some can be dangerous, and it is sad to see fellow patients who are desperate wasting money on this junk." Dr. Gunter, would you respond to Jean in terms of proven benefit? We'll see products on the market that say proven to help with such and such. Would you just talk a little bit about, I mean, there's proof and then there's proof. There's proof because the company paid for a study, and there's proof because a peer-reviewed group at the New England Journal of Medicine said, yes, this actually works. Talk about that for a second.
Well, yeah, I mean, a large part of wellness is incredibly predatory, right? So they make all kinds of claims and offer things either based on, you know, quote-unquote ancient ideas, or, untested herbal products, or, you know, everything that was mentioned there. And people who are ill are desperate, and taking something, having something like cancer makes you afraid. And when people are sounding like they're listening to you, which is, that's a big part of the wellness industrial complex, right? So they offer this empathy and they draw you in, and, you know, they offer promises, and it's very easy for people to get swayed. And, you know, while many of these things, although I'm sure the black salve is probably actually quite dangerous, we actually see some people using products like that vaginally and getting terrible, you know, burns and injuries. But, you know, this can turn people away from taking conventional therapy. And I think that whatever you're going to put in your body, you know, you have to say, if somebody's making a health claim from this, they have to back it up. Otherwise, it's just trying stuff.
I'm sorry, right? Dr. Gunter, would you back up just 1 second? Uh-huh. You said that you've seen people put it, first of all, I don't know what black salve is, but you've seen people putting it in their vagina and getting burns from it. Why? Like, what did they think it would do for them?
oh, there's all kinds of wellness influencers who, and, you know, some people who, I guess, practice some type of alternative medicine, whatever that might be, who say this can be used to, you know, to treat, you know, precancerous cells of the cervix. So, I mean, and who knows? Here's the thing. I don't know what's in that black salve. Neither do you. When you buy any of these products, you don't know actually what's in them because they're not regulated by the FDA. So, you know, we know many of these herbal products are contaminated with, you know, lead or antidepressants or other types of things. And so, you know, I think it's just, it's very much buyer beware, and people have to understand that, you know, we see all kinds of cases of, you know, injury from taking vitamins and supplements, right? People, you know, there's, you know, over 20,000 emergency department visits every year directly related to taking supplements.
Amanda, one of the big influencers is a company called Goop, which was founded by Gwyneth Paltrow. We did invite Goop to be part of the conversation or send a statement. They said they were unavailable because of scheduling, but that invitation definitely stands. Could you just give us a sense, Amanda, of the influence, of the reach of Goop? I've heard a lot about them, but how big are they really?
Goop is pretty big. Goop, the most important thing to know about it, if anybody listening doesn't, is that it's founded by Gwyneth Paltrow, who has an enormous platform on the internet and has a lot of people who admire her and trust her and are interested in knowing what she likes and what she's doing to her body. In 2018, it was estimated to be a $250 million company. It includes a website with lots of editorial content, you know, recipes, travel suggestions, fashion, things like that, as well as health-related content. It's a live events business, and it's also a retail arm. They sell things both on the internet and in brick-and-mortar locations. So it's an enormous business, and it has helped sort of usher a lot of really fringe, potentially harmful things into more mainstream conversation.
You recently wrote, Amanda, about your own time in goopification, if that is a word. What did you learn from that time?
Well, I, for The Atlantic, I went to the Goop store in downtown Manhattan, spent about $1,300 on their health and wellness products, and used them for a month. I used everything from, you know, body cream to supplement regimens to hair products, you know, all kinds of stuff. I tried to get a representative sample of what they were selling, and I used them for a month. And what became clear over time is that A lot of these wellness products are just beauty products, are no different than anything that has been sold to women, you know, in America for the past 70 years. A lot of them are beauty products. A lot of them are diet products, mostly, you know, wellness as the Goop genre deals with it is about traditional beauty standards. It's about being thin. It's about having shiny, smooth hair. It's about having clear skin. And using all of this stuff for a month and paying such minute attention to the tiny, you know, changes in my body and things like that, it became really clear how these things not only prey on people's existing anxieties, but stoke further anxieties. When you're trying to measure everything that your body is doing and decide if you feel better or decide if you feel worse or decide if some random thing that you don't really understand is working and what it means for that stuff to work, it's easy to sort of lose perspective on what you're trying to measure and just become really anxious and read more pseudoscience and buy more products and get sucked into this cycle of consumerism where you just sort of feel bad about yourself all the time and feel bad that you don't look like Gwyneth Paltrow, but you buy more stuff in an effort to get closer to that.
Dr. Gunter, I know you have some serious concerns about Goop, but for people who use products like this, not necessarily this product line, but at least product lines of this ilk, are there one or two things you would ask them to keep in mind, one or two critical questions you would ask them to ask as they consider whether this self-care regimen is really working?
Well, I think I'd actually like to say that, you know, when you go onto these sites like Goop, you're not just being exposed to these sort of beauty products that are being upsold as something to help you from a wellness standpoint, right? So again, the whole getting back to the idea that, you know, if we can, you know, basically lie about this product helping your health, we're more likely to sell it to you. But sites like Goop also have, you know, anti-vaccine information. Gwyneth Paltrow brought an AIDS denialist, for example, to the conference in New York. I sat in the audience and listened, you know, to an AIDS denialist. She didn't talk about that. But, you know, so you're, these sites often partner with people that promote medical conspiracy theories.
I'm sorry, Doctor, clarify what you mean by AIDS denialist. Denying what exactly?
That AIDS exists, that AIDS is here because of Big Pharma. Big Pharma gave us AIDS.
That's the craziest thing I ever heard.
Yes, a physician, Gwyneth Paltrow, extended her privilege to bring a physician to the conference in New York that believes that.
Well, that's not the craziest thing I ever heard because I work in Washington. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, how is that okay? How has that not gotten, and you know, again, you were there and I wasn't, and I'm just going on your account, but how does that not get Gwyneth Paltrow kind of run out of town on a rail for having someone say that?
It did. Jezebel picked up on my blog post on it. I believe Time or Newsweek magazine actually called the physician who confirmed that she still believes that AIDS isn't really a thing. And, you know, Goop said they're just having conversations. So they've, you know, abrogated all their responsibility from passing on misinformation. I mean, they recently featured on their site a diet from a naturopath, and you might read it and say, oh, look at this. I'm keto curious. Let me go check out his website. Well, on his website, he suggests that you can treat chlamydia with echinacea and garlic. So you're exposing people to all these predatory beliefs, because we actually know that people who believe in medical conspiracy theories are more likely to buy supplements. So it's a little bit of a self-sustaining cycle, isn't it?
We're really low on time, but there's one more voicemail I wanted to play, which kind of caught our interest. Here's what Ben left in our inbox.
I think that it all comes back to the Benjamin Franklin quote, moderation in all things, including moderation. I think we should all know by now what we need to do to stay well. We need to eat whole grains and fruits and vegetables, eat meat at a minimum, exercise for a half hour a few times a week. And that's about it. It's not that complicated. I've used many herbs and holistic remedies in my life. And honestly, the only thing that really stands out that has been helpful is turmeric for my inflamed knee. Otherwise, I think we need to listen to what everyone is saying and not follow all these people with different cures that are trendy. Just eat well, get some exercise, try to de-stress, listen to good music, have a loving relationship, be a kind person, and that's all you really need to do.
Ben, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Dr. Gunter, before we go, what do you make of Ben's comment?
Well, I think that it's very important for people to think about what they're trying to achieve, what's their bother factor, and what they're trying to, what's the outcome. And I think that in general, most things in moderation are fine, but not always. I mean, certainly cigarettes are not fine in moderation.
No.
So I think that you have to be really clear on that. There are many things that are not okay in moderation. Green tea leaf extract is associated with liver failure. So, you know, there are things that we would never, ever tell anyone to take. And to be mindful of really just what's the outcome that you're trying to do. And I just would add that you know, there really are gaps in medicine. There absolutely are. And, you know, I think that it's important to ask medicine to do better. And there's this really great quote from Dr. Ben Goldacre that if there's a problem with the airline industry, the answer isn't to invest in magic carpets. So people definitely deserve facts and factual information, I feel, to make informed decisions about their healthcare, because that's how you're an empowered patient.
And Dr. Gunter, just in case someone halfway heard what you said about green tea extract, you're not telling people to stop drinking green tea, right?
It's a different product. And again, that's why green tea leaf extract is associated with liver failure.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Amanda, with regards to Ben's comment before we go, what do you think? Is it just as simple as doing common sense things to live a good life and, you know, that should be enough?
I think for a lot of people, that is enough. For people who are, you know, neurotypical and people who don't have chronic health issues, I think that, you know, eating fresh foods and moving your body and being, you know, an active part of your community, I think for people who don't have, you know, extraordinary challenges, that is great. For people who have chronic health issues, for people who have mental health issues, for people who don't have access to fresh food, who don't have access to clean water, who don't have access to, you know, safe places to exercise, I think that there are a lot of systemic issues that need dressing by governments that cannot be, mediated by personal choice and cannot be mediated by consumer choice, which is where I think, the wellness industry and the wellness consumerism falls really short.
Amanda Mull, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Amanda, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Elisa Shankle, co-founder of Heal House. Thank you, Elisa.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Jen Gunter, her book is called The Vagina Bible, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Jonquilin Hill and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about JQ, Miranda, and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A. I'm feeling myself.